Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Rabbi Lizzie Heidemann. Rabbi Lizzie catalyzed the founding of Mishkan Chicago, a new Jewish faith community that describes itself this way, an unconventional kind of community, a cross-community community, designed to enhance the Jewish landscape in Chicago and create a new way in. Lizzie has received many honors because of her work, including being a 2016-17 Schusterman Fellow, a 2018 winner of the Lippman Kanfer Fellowship in Applied Jewish Wisdom, and she's listed as one of the top 20 real rabbis by MyJewishLearning.org. In our conversation, Lizzie reflected on the joys and challenges of founding of Mishkan and what it means to create a space for those who felt on the fringes of the Jewish community, what perseverance and resilience means for her and its connection to her faith, and the practices that keep her going. I hope you enjoy it. Rabbi Lizzie Heidemann, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast. I always like to start by asking folks how they got into their vocation, so I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how you got to be a rabbi and enter the rabbinate.
I guess it would be fair to say I was always a very spiritually curious child, and I did not grow up in a house where my parents really had the ability to or knowledge to model that for me. So it was a little bit do-it-yourself for me, and kind of just discovering religion and spirituality where I could, when I could. I remember being 8 years old and seeing a commercial for the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints, and that you could order a Book of Mormon for free by calling this 800 number. And I called the 800 number, and I, to this day, I have the Book of Mormon that they sent me on my shelf. And throughout high school, I would seek out spiritual bookstores and, you know, try to just understand as much as I could about different spiritual traditions. I really thought the Hare Krishna guys were interesting, and, you know, you'd see them in airports back when people could hang out in airports mm-hmm. and advertise things for flights they weren't taking. I majored in religion and philosophy in college. It's just always been like a fascination and interest of mine. And my parents did have the prescience to send me to religious school. Both of my parents are Jewish. And while neither of them had grown up, you know, keeping kosher or keeping Shabbat or engaging in Jewish spiritual practice with their families, they sensed that that was going to be important for the family they were building. So I grew up at a Reform synagogue in Hyde Park called KAM Isaiah Israel. And the rabbi of that synagogue at the time, Rabbi Arnold Jacob Wolf, may his memory be a blessing, was kind of this like controversial firebrand, liberal intellectual activist kind of rabbi. And I was catching him at the end of his career, sort of tail end of his career. And he just really modeled a rabbinate of political involvement and justice and speaking truth to power. Yeah, he was a controversial figure. There were a lot of people who didn't like him. But he was sort of like a grandfather to me and encouraged me to pursue Jewish leadership. At KAM, I learned how to play guitar and how to become a Jewish song leader. And so I started kind of combining my interest and love of music and folk music with prayer leadership, and continued that in college. And I went to Stanford as an undergrad where, there's a lot to do, but it is not known for its Jewish community. That's not why one goes to Stanford University, maybe more so now. But at the time, the Hillel was like a couple rooms in the basement of a cultural student, you know, union building. And all of the different denominations had to figure out how to pray together and eat together and make community together, because there weren't that many of us who wanted to practice. And so it was while I was there that I think I realized my academic interest, my spiritual curiosity, and also some of my hobbies like guitar playing and singing all lent themselves to spiritual leadership. my freshman year of college, I had the opportunity to travel to El Salvador with the American Jewish World Service, which is a Jewish social justice organization that supports grassroots organizations around the world. They do not do Jewish missionizing when they go and support organizations around the world. The idea is really to support the people on the ground who already know what they're doing, and to let them know the Jewish community stands with them and supports them. And here in America, they've been doing more and more advocacy work so that the Jewish community has a voice in promoting issues of justice and healing around the world. So I went on a trip with them, and a rabbi came on that trip. And I think it was actually on that trip, seeing how that rabbi, whose name was Dorothy Richmond, could integrate prayer and justice work and communal leadership, pastoral, you know, working with individuals, both the Spanish-speaking individuals in the town of Ciudad Romero, where we were, you know, building houses, and also the students on this trip, you know, like dramatically different stories and histories and socioeconomic privilege and religious backgrounds. And I thought, like, what an incredible vocation. I had to think about, do I want to pursue academia? You know, I was writing my honors thesis as a senior on Jewish mysticism, and particularly postmodern Jewish mysticism, like modern, in the modern age, you know, modern philosophers and rabbis writing and thinking about what a non-dual God language and observance and all of that really means. And it was in the midst of writing like a 100-page paper about, you know, God and mysticism and the unity of all things. And I was just like, I don't want to write about this from a critical academic perspective. I want to preach this and teach this and think about how this actually helps us live in the world in more connected, purposeful ways. So that's the long, short answer.
It's eerie, the phrase that you use about not wanting to write about it, but being, as you said, preach about it, be more engaged with it, is almost exactly my own kind of call story of thinking about writing and journalism as a career, but instead deciding to kind of to get in there and be involved in people's lives in a more intimate way. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how you founded Mishkan. And I think for folks who listen to this in the United Methodist Church or other churches, they may know a little bit about how churches get started, but I don't think we hear quite as much about how synagogues get started. So I'm curious about your own journey of how this came to be.
I am from Chicago. I love this city. I grew up mostly on the South Side. And, you know, strangely, I moved to California for college, and then rabbinical school I did in Los Angeles. And I didn't know that I would eventually move back here. I think when I moved to Northern California especially, I thought, oh my God, this place is the Garden of Eden. Like, I want to live here forever. I want to move back here after school is over. But when I was turning 30 and living in Los Angeles, I just realized I wanted to be here. Like, I wanted to be in Chicago in the way one feels called to do something. I felt like I was being called to come back to Chicago. And at that time, I was working at a community in Los Angeles called Ikar. Ikar in Hebrew means the essence. And it was the name of a spiritual community that at the time I joined it was very young, sort of a startup community like Mishkan was in 2011. When I joined ECAR as a rabbinical student, they were maybe 2 years old, and their thing was standing at the intersection of spirituality and social justice. I was an intern there, and then I became their first second rabbi. And I was a year into that and just realized, you know, everything about that community, the justice work, the focus on traditional observance, but in a creative and sort of irreverent way, the reaching out to and really embracing people with diverse backgrounds and identities. I mean, all of that spoke to me. I needed to be in Chicago. And so I began to explore the question of, like, where in Chicago did such a community exist? Not because I needed to work there, but because I wanted to attend there and would probably find a different job doing something else. And the more I asked people whether such a community existed and where it was, they just, you know, sort of, they didn't know what to say. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't even understand the question I was asking because there was no frame of reference for such a community here. People said things like, well, that sounds, you know, a community like that sounds like really appropriate for Los Angeles or New York. That sounds very coastal, you know, sort of like New York elite, or like something like that could exist in a place with maybe like a more diverse Jewish community like New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco. Or that sounds so spiritual, not very Midwestern, you know, like, come on, what is that? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You don't think people in the Midwest like have souls, you know? So I just sort of felt like, okay,
they just don't want people to know about it.
Right. It's just, you know, our secret thing. And, you know, so, you know, then I actually started to do the research. The Jewish United Fund had just done a demographic study of Jews in Chicago, and there's something like 100,000 Jews in the city of Chicago, another 200,000 in the suburbs, roughly. And I was, as a city kid, concerned mostly with the city. And the vast majority of these people are, you know, what we would say, like, unaffiliated. You know, they don't go to synagogue. And I don't think that is because people are not spiritual. I think people are spiritual. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why they don't go. Mm-hmm. So I felt like there was room. There was an invitation. That's what it felt like. And I had a lot of conversations over the phone while I was still in Los Angeles with community builders here and people, you know, sort of in the organized, established community, rabbis, people who worked inside of, you know, JUF. And I talked to a lot of Jews. And at a certain point, I had an email list of about 50 people, culled both from the synagogue in Glencoe, Eitz Chaim, where I was working part-time, and also culled from events that I was attending here in the city when I moved in early July 2011, and I just hit the ground running, and I had some business cards, and every time I went anywhere, I just would talk about this project that I wanted to get off the ground called Mishkan.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a spiritual community where we took social justice seriously and where we took prayer and music to new heights and where we built community among people who didn't find community or hadn't found community in the usual Jewish spaces. And we weren't going to have a building. We were going to meet in unconventional, you know, sort of you know, places where it's possible to be spiritual that are not necessarily religious buildings. Sort of ironically, I guess, we now meet in a synagogue once a month and in a church the other two times a month that we have services regularly. I got an email list together and eventually we had our first service.
Yeah. Can I ask, did you, as you were thinking about loving the community you had in Los Angeles and when you first realized there was not a community in Chicago, was there an immediate feeling for like, I need to be the one to start this? Or did you feel like, well, I hope somebody else starts this because I'd love to be a part of it?
I think I felt called to start it.
Hmm.
And that was because I'd been trained at ICAR where, you know, I think for them too, there was this sense of, even in Los Angeles with all the options that existed for all of the different ways that Jews might want to observe, something was missing. And the, you know, origin story of ICAR was kind of the birth of a group, the birth of a space by a group of people who hadn't been served by the traditional community, you know, as diverse as it was, as sort of entrepreneurial spirit. That's what trained me. And so when, you know, when you're an entrepreneur and you see a hole somewhere, you ask, like, is it my job to fill it? And I felt like I actually had the training and the background and the love of this city to be the one to come in and do that. Like, it was my job. I felt like it was my job.
You, on your website, you talk about those folks where you want to connect folks who have been on the fringes of the Jewish community, queer Jews, people in interfaith relationships, spiritual seekers, Jews of color, Jews by choice. Did you know, as you were passing out your business cards, did you know immediately, like, these are probably some of the folks who may have not felt like they have connected to a more traditional synagogue? Or did that realization come as you were having these conversations?
You know, I think the Jewish community now in 2018 is in a much better place than we were in 2011, with regard to awareness of inclusivity issues. In 2011, it was still a little bit radical to actively and articulate this is a home for people from interfaith backgrounds, LGBTQ Jews, people, you know, Jews of color, people who aren't Jewish, you know, like spiritual seekers. Mm-hmm. Now I feel like communities are much more deliberate in like stating and trying to fulfill the intention to be welcoming. But, you know, it was as much about transcending all of the labels of the reasons why people felt like they'd been othered and left out, and making a proactive description of what does a visionary spiritual community feel like? What does it look like? How do we pray? And for many Jews, the question of like, what is prayer and what is God? Who is God? You know, like really foundational religious and spiritual questions are very alienating to Jews because there are so many different aspects to Jewish identity,
right?
You know, and so when you talk to, you know, many Jewish people and ask them what Jewish identity means to them, they'll talk about Friday night dinners with their family. They'll talk about Rosh Hashanah meals with their family. They'll talk about Passover Seders, which are totally ritual moments. But for whatever reason, they don't feel religious. You know, they feel familial. They feel cultural. Mm. And what I was talking about was religion, you know, which I think for many Jewish people, my own family of origin included, feels a little scary. And so I wanted to create a place where, and I wanted to myself be in a place where we could feel safe to ask really big questions and not feel judged for asking them, no matter what kind of background we came from.
Did you, you said that in 2018, that folks are at a better, I don't know if better is the right word, but a different place now than even 7 years ago. When you first started out and were asking these questions and engaging with folks, was the response from more traditional synagogues one of, we're so glad you're here because this is really meeting a niche in our community? Or was there a little bit of resistance? Or maybe a mix.
Yeah, I would say a mix, but more of the former.
Okay.
And the reason why more of the former was because, at least at the outset, at the beginning, one of the target audience groups, you could say, was young adults. You know, like my peers and the peers of the other young organizers who were part of the, you know, the first rollout of Mishkan in 2011. You know, we were all in our like early and mid and late 20s, early 30s. And that is traditionally a group of people that synagogues have admittedly not done a great job serving for all kinds of different reasons. But for that reason, it wasn't like we were going to be stealing the market share of, you know, all of the young adults who are all attending synagogue, and we were going to be drawing them away from existing relationships with synagogues. You know, in truth, some really small fraction of people in that age demographic affiliate with synagogues. So the feeling was like, great, Mishkan, you want to create a space, you know, figure out how to pay for it because, you know, those people don't pay and, you know, so we won't miss them and you guys do your thing. And then when those people are ready to have bar and bat mitzvahs for their children, they will go to the synagogue up the street. And that was kind of how it was maybe supposed to work.
Yeah.
And then the plan changed a few years in when it became clear the young adults who were meeting and marrying at Mishkan didn't want to like graduate from Mishkan to go to the synagogue up the street. They wanted me to do their wedding, and they wanted to raise their kids at the Mensch Academy, which is our kids' religion and spirituality program. They wanted Mishkan for their children and for their families. And so we ended up having to create essentially a whole family ethos, which is great. And I think it's a really positive evolution, but that has put a slight strain on our relationship with some of the synagogues in the area. But it is really important to say, I have such positive relationships with every single rabbi in the city, and we're really collegial. And to the extent that it is possible to work in really friendly, generative, collaborative ways, we do. And I think that's super unique to Chicago. I know many rabbis in other cities where they started similar communities where they were not nearly as well received, where, you know, other synagogues and rabbis and organizations tried to snuff them out, you know, in active or passive ways. That by no means happened here. People were actually incredibly welcoming and positive.
I love what you said earlier about, I guess it touches on a little bit in Christian circles, there's a lot of talk about the folks who categorize themselves as spiritual but not religious. And you had mentioned that in talking to some of, as you were having these listening sessions and talking with folks, that there were people when they would talk about their own faith, their own Judaism, their own Jewish faith, that they would think of Friday night dinners, and it would be in familial terms, not necessarily religious terms.
And I mean, even to say Jewish faith would be anathema to many Jews.
Really? Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So what is it about that I guess makes them either uncomfortable or leery of using that language?
For many people, the joy of Jewish practice and identity comes from stuff that happens at home. Shabbat dinner, Rosh Hashanah dinner, or Yom Kippur break fast, Passover seders, you know, conversations with and relationships with grandparents who spoke Yiddish, or, you know, who sort of carried a little bit of whatever, like the old, either the old country or, you know, like Lower East Side of New York, or, you know, like a kind of cultural experience of being distinctively Jewish, whether in America or, you know, in somewhere else in the world, that is like tactile, you know, and it comes out in the food, and it comes out in the language, and it comes out in the way that we talk to each other in a sort of feisty, even sometimes argumentative way, but nonetheless really loving. And these are all aspects of like Jewish culture.
Okay.
You know, like Jewish culture is kind of like a juicy, feisty culture.
Right.
And for anybody who has learned Talmud, you know, the fact that in the Talmud, this religious book, it's all arguments, you know, that rabbis are having with one another across generations. So then you know that, you know, the literary tradition, the religious tradition, the intellectual tradition of argument and challenge, that's part and parcel of the cultural identity we have as people who ask questions and people who challenge authority. And but not everybody has studied Talmud. You know, but they do know that in their family, they have really good political arguments over dinner. And so, you know, whether it's Talmud or whether it's like opening up a prayer book, which also, you know, has a lot of Hebrew, which for most American Jews is a foreign language, you know, really foreign language, that you may have studied in religious school, but it's not like in studying 2 hours a week or 4 hours a week, even, you can really deeply learn how to understand and unpack poetry in a foreign language, religious poetry in a foreign language, you know, talking about God, which is, you know, like how do you even start a conversation about like what is the reality of the universe, you know? And then to do so in a foreign language, you know, with 2,000 years, 3,000 years of literary background, again, in a foreign language, that's much less accessible than the way that a Passover Seder feels. you know, or like your grandma's matzo ball soup tasted. So I think those memories and experiences are just much more, they're closer to the surface, mm-hmm. you know, or, okay. or like justice, you know, justice involvement and Jewish, the Jewish imperative to like toward tikkun olam and building a better world, or, you know, the mitzvah, the commandment in the Torah that says tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, you will pursue justice. You will surely pursue justice. And the different stories in the Torah that have to do with characters like Abraham or like Moses standing up with righteous indignation to challenge authority and try to save people's lives. That those stories and that those instincts are much closer to the surface, much more accessible, much more tangible, more actionable than the spiritual, some of the aspects of spiritual tradition. Yeah. And so you get Jewish people who are like, you know, Nobel Prize winners in other areas of their lives, but when it comes to Jewish spirituality, like really haven't thought about things since the age of 12 mm. when, you know, 12 or 13, when they had their perfunctory bar bat mitzvah, learned a bunch of words in a foreign language, and then left the synagogue completely because like it didn't mean anything to them. Mm. And so then as adults, we come back in and we're like, I don't have the keys.
Yeah.
How do I unlock this?
Interesting. So it's more about, they're almost out of practice. It's not necessarily, maybe it's part of this too. Are there any stereotypes for folks who would say they're culturally Jewish, for them to hear that someone would say, I'm a religious Jew. Does that come with some stereotypes of like what kind of person that is?
I mean, probably, you know, if a person, there are plenty of people who come to services regularly at Mishkan mm-hmm. who would not say, I am a religious Jew mm. because they think to themselves, I don't wear the black hat. Okay. I don't have the, you know, the side curls. I don't wear a prayer shawl 24 hours a day, or, you know, like I don't look like one of the religious Jews that probably mostly pop culture
right.
says that religious Jews look like. You know, as it turns out, religious Jews come in all sizes and shapes and races and backgrounds. And if you just, you know, walk around Lakeview for 20 minutes without knowing it, you'll pass, you know, a minion of religious Jews. So I encourage people at Mishkan to reclaim the identity of being religious, because I feel like we live in a culture right now that is allowing people who claim to be religious to speak in the name of religion mm. and God in ways that are desecrations of God, in ways that denigrate and make a mockery of religion. Yeah. And if none of us give a counter testimony, then they win.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate it. That's really helpful. I appreciate you saying that. I wanted to, so that the basis of this podcast is talking about failure. And so I wanted to read an excerpt from this article that I came across about Judaism and failure. I'm going to read part of this and would love to kind of hear some of your reflections on it. So the article says this, that there's an old saying from the Yiddish that asks how we should define tzaddik. I got that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Tzaddik, from the same root as tzedek or tzedekah.
Tzedakah.
Thank you. Literally means one who is righteous and just. It is usually used to describe someone who is wise and highly respected. But the old Yiddish saying defines the tzaddik as one who makes new mistakes. And then the author goes on, to err is human, but our ability to pull ourselves back from harmful patterns of behavior, to reflect on what has gone wrong, and to choose our response when we are aware of our failures, this is a vital part of one's life's journey. And our Torah and traditions teach us that this is an important part of our spiritual journey too, as individuals and as a community of faith. Hmm. I'd love to hear your responses to that.
Hmm. A tzaddik is a person who makes new mistakes. The role of the tzaddik in Jewish lore and history is usually to be sort of the paragon, like the example that everybody wants to follow, like that you watch how the tzaddik ties his shoes, you know, so that you can learn how to tie your shoes in a divine conscious way, and watch how the tzaddik speaks with, you know, his wife, or how he prays, and that these are all things to emulate and learn from, and that the tzaddik is sort of like a guru almost. And I love the idea that the tzaddik is one who makes new mistakes, because that is to say, a tzaddik is a person who doesn't rest on their laurels. They're constantly exploring and experimenting, and that's the behavior to be emulated, as opposed to, you know, what we usually think of when we think of religious leaders or religious institutions, which is, you know, people or places that have grown a little bit stale, you know, and kind of stuck in habits that no longer serve the people. And that's the constant challenge of any religious institution. This is, you know, Brother David Steindl-Rast has this metaphor of the volcano, and that religion in its inception is like the exploding lava from an active volcano, just this like fiery, even dangerous outpouring, you know, almost uncontrolled of passion. And that over time it cools off and it becomes cold, dead rock. And you would never have known that underneath that cold, dead rock and inside of it was fire.
Yeah.
You know, and that every religion is born with mysticism and ends in like doctrine, you know, and the doctrine becomes doctrinaire, and the morals become moralistic, and the rituals become ritualistic and rote. And so the idea that a tzaddik is one who doesn't let that happen and is constantly taking new risks is a really good invitation to those of us who are religious leaders. You know, I don't need anybody to think of me as a guru or as a tzaddik, and I hope they don't, because I think I would be very disappointing. but I do want the permission of those who come to Mishkan, who consider me their rabbi, to fail.
Yeah.
You know, to make mistakes and to make new mistakes once I've gotten the old ones right.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things we've tried to do with in our own community too, is every week in worship, we have testimony. So somebody comes up and takes a few minutes and answers the basic question, what is God doing in your life? And we really give them free rein to say whatever. And so there are times when they may say something that theologically I might not be quite on the same page with. Or they may say, I'm really struggling right now with what I believe, or any number of things. And to leave that space for folks to know that, in a sense, for that those few minutes, they're the paragon, that they're the ones who are exploring and asking those big questions, which you talked about, which we try to emphasize for folks too. I appreciate you saying that. And paragon is not perfection necessarily, but somebody who's going to continue to risk and try and... and hopefully get back up again.
But it's like a cultural norm to establish within the community, because I think people expect perfection of, I mean, of any vendor with whom we work, you know, or, you know, organization, company we hire to do a job. I think people are hiring us to do a job. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that in, like a pejorative way, but I think people are coming to us thirsty and it's our job to give them water. And every now and again, for whatever reason, the water's not going to taste good, or it's going to taste good to like 99% of the people. And then there's one person who's like, this is disgusting, you know, and then write a really nasty email
or a bad review on Yelp
or like call the office and like say really nasty things to somebody who wasn't even present or had nothing to do with the thing they're talking about. And, you know, so to both set norms that remind people that part of our job as a spiritual community in being spiritual literally means to be open to the new, you know, and to be experimenting with the new, and then to like really love people hard when they have a hard time with that.
Yeah. How do you respond in those moments when you receive the email or the note or the phone call and they're saying, I can't believe you said that. I can't believe this community is doing that. I have no time for this anymore. And those moments where you may wonder to yourself, why did I get into this business? What keeps you going? What helps you to kind of persevere and get back up again the next day?
You know, this is one area where I feel like social media has actually really helped. Because people talk about how, you know, devastatingly isolating social media can be for many of us. And I think it is in all of the ways that the studies show. And also, every day when I, you know, see on Facebook that my colleagues around the country are posting different reasons why they are refusing to give in to despair and why despair and hopelessness is not an option and is not a strategy, and whether or not we're religious figures, religious leaders, or just regular people, like, we are entitled to our moments of frustration. You know, we should have them and have the people that we talk to about them. And, you know, my husband Henry hears me complain more than I would complain to anybody else. But, you know, part of that is just like burning off the steam so that I can continue to have hope and nurture that hope. And part of the nurturing of that hope is being around other people who are struggling also themselves to have hope and can testify to, you know, how that works for them so that I can do the same for my community. I will say Shabbat, the practice every week of deciding, you know, taking a conscious step and, you know, with every part of my being, changing my posture to one of living in a world that does not need to be fixed and is not broken for 24 hours, 25 hours, to decide, like, today I'm going to see the light and the good and the positive and that which I am grateful for and that which is working and that which gives me hope, gives me the strength to then go back into the week and try to create the world that I just lived in for 25 hours on Shabbat.
Yeah.
So that's a really restorative practice. And then, like, every Jewish holiday, honestly, is a different, you know, like a different booster shot for a particular, I would say, like, aspect of psychology or emotion or a kind of spiritual posture, you know. Rosh Hashanah is all about cultivating the capacity for, like, radical change in your own life and in the world. Yom Kippur is all about being able to forgive yourself, other people, and, like, deep levels of atonement and, you know, shifting of one's way of being in the world. Every single holiday has a different kind of angle on this stuff. And so trying to use the tradition for the psychological and spiritual bolstering that I think it is inherently designed to provide. And in those moments when it doesn't feel like it's inherently designed to provide that, trying to harness and transform the tradition into a tradition that delivers that and that provides that for me and for other people, that's the work. And so even on days when it's hard, that just reinforces the importance of the work.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I always end these conversations with folks asking them if they would share a failure story of their own. And so this could be personal or professional, whatever. So would you mind sharing a story with us?
I am not a perfectionist. That's not, like, one of the genes that I was born with. I do care about things being excellent, you know. I do have a high standard for, you know, the way our services look and feel, the way our website looks and feels, the way our materials look and feel, the way our office looks and feels. Like, I don't feel like I'm a perfectionist about those things, or for myself. You know, I don't think that I hold myself to a standard of perfection that makes it so that I'm constantly disappointing myself, which I'm really grateful for, and I credit my parents with, you know, not instilling in me, because it makes it so that I can actually mostly live up. But I think especially recently, not just since Trump got elected, but maybe with the rise of social media and the 24-hour news cycle and just bad news being so relentless and constant. And I do feel a certain constant pressure to be responding, to be a moral leader, to be somebody with something to say about everything that happens, and to know, like, the Jewish source that is the, you know, Talmudic equivalent back in, you know, the year 300 CE that, you know, gives us insight into how to, you know, process, you know, the Supreme Court's decision, or, you know, to on the spot be able to deliver, like, the right prayer or the right words, the right framing, you know, just the right insight for the moment, constantly, relentlessly. And, you know, unsurprisingly, I can't do that. And I do feel like that is a failure. Oh my God, look at me. I'm going to cry. Because, you know, the truth is, like, I need moral guidance and leadership too. And a lot of the things that I say as a leader, I think I'm mostly talking to myself, you know, like, I'm saying what I need to hear, and what I imagine, therefore, other people need to hear or want to hear. But I think the constant sort of internal pressure, you know, nobody's saying to me, Rabbi Lizzie, like, you need to send out an email about this, you know, and then another one tomorrow and another one the day after that, because that's what a responsible religious leader would be doing right now. But I think internally I feel a sense of disappointment in myself and almost like a constant failure for not being in a constantly more reactive and responsive, a compassionately, thoughtfully, insightfully responsive posture toward everything that's happening in the world.
Yeah, I 100% am on the same page as that, in the same, particularly on social media. And be, I mean, every single day there could be something that we could be responding to.
Multiple times a day.
Right. And always wanting to, for me anyway, wanting to parse the phrase in such a way that makes people think differently. And also when I hear from folks who say, thank you so much for saying the things that you're saying. Well, on one hand, I appreciate that. It also does kind of sometimes ramp up the pressure. Like, I got to keep this going because people are depending on me, which may or may not be true. I mean, at times it's true, but at times it's not. And so, so I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Well, Rabbi Lizzie, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and having this conversation.
Thanks so much for inviting me to be part of it.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Rabbi Lizzie for speaking with me. You can learn more about her by liking her public page on Facebook, or you can learn about Mishkan, that's M-I-S-H-K-A-N, by going to its website, mishkanchicago.org, or their Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter accounts. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast. My next guest will be Judge Ginger Lerner-Wren, who presides over the country's first mental health court, which was created in Florida in 1997. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.